Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I must confess that the remarks I'm going to make are somewhat bearish, and they don't really bear on what the chairman has outlined. But I think that they're important enough to discuss. So let me start, and I'll read this out. With sustained world economic growth and buoyant share markets, it is understandable that many investors feel euphoric. But I would caution the need for a reality check to keep your feet firmly on the ground. We are living in Goldilocks economic times where problems are swept under the carpet. On Reserve Bank forecasts, Australia will grow at around 3.25% in 2007 in non-farm GDP, and with the El Nino ending and hopefully the worst of the drought, total GDP will be a little higher. In the US, the Federal Reserve is forecasting GDP growth of 2.5% to 3% in 2007, despite sharply declining housing trends with a rapid rise in some prime loan defaults. Euroland and Japan are also expected to grow around this size. After last year's 10.7% growth in China's GDP, the World Bank estimates a slight fall to 9.6% in 2007. But the 10% level is more probable. To dampen excess liquidity in China, there have been 5 increases in the required reserve ratio for banks in 8 months, with the latest increase this month. India's GDP growth is accelerating this year to 9%, but at a cost to higher inflation. The Reserve Bank of India is concerned at the level of overheating, and this month alone tightened monetary policy twice in 2 weeks. The commodity super cycle remains intact, and although the direction is still positive, there is sharp volatility mainly to the downside, which will remain a feature for the whole year. There are 2 exceptions, with the crude oil price stabilising and are now again on the rise, and the gold price, which keeps on nudging up. Around the world, inflation will be a little higher than in 2006, and central bank interest rates will rise this year in Britain, the European Union and India, with the US and Australia to at least stay the same, but with a tightening monetary policy bias. Even Japan's ultra-low interest rate was nudged up only 3 days ago to a momentous 0.5%. There are risks to the current world growth scenario. Bird flu might finally take hold with a vengeance, and terrorism is always lurking around the corner. But the biggest risk of all, in my mind, is the giant surge of liquidity around the world, fueled by a chase for higher yielding assets. It has encouraged an excessive use of derivative instruments and an absurdly low level of risk premia in the financial markets. Unless this is reversed, and it's very unlikely that it will eventually spill over into a financial crisis, I feel most likely over the next 3 years. Many market participants now seem to have amnesia of what risk really is. They believe as if the vast well of liquidity in the financial system will last indefinitely and that volatility is a thing of the past. This is delusional. Take the unlimited lending to private equity groups. With a giant war chest, they are buying larger and larger companies with investors such as pension funds and the investment arms of international banks and investment banks keen to be part of the act. Private equity acquisitions are initially funded by short-term bridging bank finance and then subsequently termed out with 3 to 5 year bank debt. There is also a large use of relatively illiquid securities in credit default swaps, total return swaps and synthetic collateralised debt obligations. In 2006, the value of private equity firm buyouts in the US and Europe reached a record $440 billion US. Many of the deals are done on a club basis, where a number of private equity firms pay for the deal and then split up the assets between them. Although they hate the word, these private equity players are really large conglomerates using excessive levels of leveraged debt. One such private equity group, Carlyle, alone controls companies with 200,000 employees and revenues of $68 billion US, and there are other similar conglomerates of at least this size. The largest private equity acquisition to date after a bitter takeover fight was the $39.2 billion US deal by Blackstone, including assumption of debt, to buy equity office properties in the US. Given that 540 office properties are involved, this is no more than a giant bet that the sharply rising office rents and land values will keep on rising indefinitely. Dealmakers on Wall Street are now contemplating private equity acquisitions of $60 billion US and even maybe $90 billion. So I ask the question, is there no limit to the new barbarians at the gate? If you add the marauding leverage funds with little or no regulatory oversight, it is becoming a game of high-flying trapeze artists without a safety net if they fail. The consequences of this torrent of more liquid and leveraged asset classes has led to undue distortions in the financial markets, making it more difficult for central banks and bank regulators to keep informed about the likelihood of systemic risks if and when they develop. The head of structured credit research at Barclays Capital in London says that by expanding the investor base for corporate credit risk, the growth of synthetic CDOs are compressing the spreads available to corporate bond investors. And he explained that bondholders have halved the amount they charge high-risk companies over the past 4 years to a record low 2.6 percentage points over US Treasury notes. Yet the CDOs that invest in derivatives of investment-grade bonds return as much as 12% a year. And this, I feel, is an excessive reward for speculative investment. At the Davos meeting of the World Economic Forum, there was a raging debate about whether the lack of transparency in structured finance products would lead to the eventual undoing of the financial markets. The optimists say this lack of transparency need not matter, since counterparties handling derivatives such as investment banks have a high incentive to monitor risks. But is this the case? The Council of Financial Regulators in Australia and bank regulators in the major industrial countries are worried that the banks, which were able through credit derivatives to offload risky loans from their balance sheets, may be reacquiring risk via the back door. This is because the investment arms of banks are buying repackaged risk products or lending to hedge funds. Now, hedge funds are giving some of the risk back to the banks. And the Financial Times has reported that regulators in the US, UK and Europe have expressed concern in recent meetings that investment banks may be allowing hedge funds to increase their borrowing capacity using collateral that could lose its value rapidly in a financial crisis. The regulators have asked banking executives to detail exactly how they use portfolio netting, a practice that allows hedge funds to use relatively illiquid securities, such as the credit derivatives, as collateral to reduce overall margin requirements. The fear amongst regulators is that in a big market dislocation, where liquidity might suddenly disappear, traders might be unable to escape from positions where losses are ballooning because nobody would be willing in that situation to deal. Hedge funds might be unable to sell those securities, increasing the likelihood of widespread defaults. So to come back to where I've started, and it's not about water, and it's not about global warming, vitally important as these are, the Goldilocks international economy, where everything appears rosy on the surface, may not be so rosy underneath. If you drill down to the potential for future financial stress, the signs are all in place for a financial market crash, possibly over the next 3 years. I remind you of the financial market crash in 1987, when portfolio insurance was the new big thing. The impact on the Australian Stock Exchange at the time, from its peak in September 1987 over the following 3 months, was a substantial drop of 48%. Although a recession wasn't triggered at that time, the share market collapse encouraged a frenzied wave of property speculation, which was one of the causes of the 1990 recession. Do you remember the recession we had to have? And in turn led to substantial corporate failures. The 1998 collapse of long-term capital management, a hedge fund where two of the three partners were Nobel Prize winners in economics, with a so-called foolproof mathematical model to protect the markets, came unglued after $3 billion US was suddenly ballooned into a debt level of $100 billion US to cash in on super profits. The LTCM collapse didn't trigger a financial crisis. It was cleaned up by the Federal Reserve intervening, with the outfit sold at a to a group of rich investors, investment banks, at a salvage price. This time around, the financial stakes are much larger. The international ramifications are now too big for any one central bank, and the spillover effects are going to be much larger. Now, I sincerely hope, and you do, of course, I sincerely hope that this scenario doesn't happen. Indeed, it may only be a result of an over-imaginative nightmare on my part. But it would be stupid for economists and policymakers to ignore the possibilities. And I'll stop at that point. Thank you very much.